Welcome to A New Prescription, where we explore modern healthcare, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and the complexities of healthcare politics. Join us as we provide insights and solutions to help you navigate the American healthcare system. Welcome to A New Prescription, a podcast where we help you navigate the American healthcare system. I'm your co-host, Andrew Zwelling. You might ask, am I a doctor? No, I'm not. Do I have any expertise to comment about healthcare? Probably not. And that's why I have my co-host, Dr. Leonard A. Zwelling. Dad, say hello to our viewers.
What's up to the nation? Hey, everybody. Glad to have you back.
Are you excited? You excited about today?
I am excited about today. This is a very important subject. I studied it long and hard, so I'm really interested to hear what our guest has to say.
Yeah, I'm so excited about today's guest, Scott Wham. Scott is the Director of Compliance and Innovation at One Digital, where he helps employees and employers navigate their ever-changing policies. Their mission is to optimize benefits while keeping companies compliant and their workforces strong. Beyond his role at One Digital, Scott is a passionate advocate for smarter healthcare policies. He's deeply involved in the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals, the NABIP, serving at Pennsylvania's board and previously leading the Greater Philadelphia chapter. Scott is also a sought-after speaker on healthcare policy and has even taught classes at his alma mater, Villanova University, where he received his law degree. And then our tie together is we both went to Johns Hopkins, where he was a BA in political science, and also we were together on the baseball team. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. We're so excited to have you.
Andrew, doctor, thank you for that wonderful introduction. And I think Andrew did a lot more baseball playing than I did at Johns Hopkins. But I'm so excited to be here and really excited to have this conversation with you guys today.
Thank you so much for joining us. I really just want to start with your background. Just, you know, it's been 16 years since you and I have seen each other. You've done a lot in healthcare policy. You know, just give us an introduction to what you've done, what you're doing. We'd love for our nation, just understand who you are within the healthcare policy making ecosystem.
Absolutely. Yeah. So like Andrew said, we went to college together. And when I was in college, I studied political science, where I was fairly obsessed with asking big questions about healthcare systems internationally. I was very interested in the question of why is the American healthcare system different here than it is in other Western developed nations? When I went to law school, it was a really interesting time to be in law school because we were having the largest national debate on health policy that we had had since 1994. And some of you who are old enough to remember, back in 1994, Hillary Clinton was tasked with taking a look at the global landscape of the American healthcare system and lobbying for some pretty substantial changes, met some incredible headwinds, and ended up dying on the vine. But that mantle was picked up in earnest after the election of Obama in 2008. And I started law school in 2008. And when I graduated in 2011, the Affordable Care Act had become the law of the land. When I got out of law school, I went to go work for a law firm for about a year where I was doing litigation, representing employers and insurance carriers against what were predominantly fraudulent workers' compensation claims. And one of the features that I recognized pretty quickly in the cases that made it to my desk, because if you get to the point of litigation in Pennsylvania for a workers' compensation claim, I should say I'm from Pennsylvania. I live in outside Philadelphia. If you get to the point of litigation for a workers' compensation claim, there's usually something fishy about that claim. And the one feature that I saw time and time again was that people who were filing fraudulent workers' compensation claims were oftentimes uninsured. They were oftentimes without insurance, and they would, you know, stage a work accident to seek coverage for an injury or illness that had occurred outside the workplace. But because they didn't have insurance or a means of paying for that treatment, they would, in desperation, oftentimes stage work accidents. And it was a very sad insight into the state of where we were back in 2011 from a health insurance access and a payer access perspective. And we'll talk about what all these terms mean as we move on. But I had this amazing opportunity to leave that law firm and go work for an organization that works with predominantly small to mid-sized companies. So I work with employers who offer health and welfare benefit plans to their employees that have between 2 employees and really 1,000 employees, maybe a couple companies that are 2,000 employees. So really small to mid-sized companies who are often left out of big conversations regarding health policy. Over the course of the past 13 years, I've worked with thousands of employers. My company represents about 100,000 employers across the country, trying to help them figure out ways to turn a one-year employee into a two-year employee and building a culture that individuals want to be a part of. And my focus is really on the health and welfare benefit side, but we talk about HR consulting and what financial well-being and all different types of ways that employers can invest in their employees. And in conjunction with my role in working with employers, I've had the privilege of being able to specialize in a law that when I entered the industry was brand new. The Affordable Care Act was signed into law in 2010. When I was in law school, the only thing I kept hearing at the time was no one read it, right? So I said to myself, well, what happens if someone reads this law? Yeah, what can you do? So I read the law and I got real into it. And not only was I reading it, but I was practicing it with employers, because a lot of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act impact employer-sponsored health plans and health plans generally. And in fairly quick order, it was only me and a handful of other people around the country who had really gotten into this law. And it was a really fast and interesting way to gain expertise in a new law that was monumental. I started getting invited down to DC to give congressional briefings and talk about what we're seeing works in the law, what maybe doesn't work in the law and should be tweaked. But over the past years, I've had the privilege of working with the Obama administration, the first Trump administration, the Biden administration, the second Trump administration, in a very bipartisan, nonpartisan fashion, talk about reasonable health policy. That's how I got to this space. I'm still very much involved with consulting with employers and consulting with lawmakers, both at the state and federal level.
Let's go back to the very beginning of how we get insured in the United States. How do we get insured in the United States? Because it sounds to me like there's not one system, but many, depending on all kinds of things. And you sound like the man to talk to about these things. So how do we get insured in the United States for healthcare issues?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it gets right to the heart of where some of the complexity that we see in the United healthcare system, the United States healthcare system, originates. And it's the diversity of what we call payers in my industry that are in the market. And payers, when we use that term, we're talking about entities that pay for healthcare claims. And there are a few different buckets of payers that exist globally in the United States. One I'm going to start with is the individual market. Many individuals in this country are not offered health insurance through their employer or perhaps during college and they're not on their parents' plan. They need to find health insurance. And the place where the majority of those individuals go to find health insurance is what's called the individual market, where you buy an individual private health insurance policy to pay for your health claims. And each month, you pay a premium for that coverage. The second bucket, which is the largest bucket of individuals who are receiving private health insurance, is through the employer-sponsored market. The vast majority of Americans receive their health insurance through the employer-sponsored market. About 180 million Americans are insured through their employer. And those employers work oftentimes with insurance carriers to offer plans. And sometimes companies, when they're large enough, are actually administering those plans with their own dollars. But at the end of the day, it's used as a talent attraction and retention tool by employers to compete for talent. We can talk about upsides and downsides to that model as we move on. But that's the largest bucket. 180 million Americans receive their health insurance through their employer. The other payers that are major pieces of the puzzle as well are the government programs. So Medicare and Medicaid are the two largest government programs that insure approximately the rest of the population, right? You have about 75 million individuals who are enrolled through Medicaid, which is a program that generally speaking tends to offer benefits, health insurance benefits to individuals who are lower income, and it varies from state to state how that operates. This is going to be a big topic of today. And then Medicare, which is what pays for health claims for individuals who reached the age of 65 and above or have some form of disability that would render them incapable of working prior to age 65. That is the second largest payer block in the country. So Medicare's a big topic, Medicaid's a big topic, and then the private insurance markets are a huge topic, and they are all intricately interrelated. One does not exist without impacting the other.
Where does Obamacare fit in?
So the Affordable Care Act was, to me, the most revolutionary law of our lifetime. And when I say our lifetime, I'm talking about Andrew and I. Doctor, you've seen some revolutionary laws in your time.
Yeah, that's right.
But the Affordable Care Act was an attempt to solve the problem of access to payers. Okay. The Affordable Care Act was at its core an attempt to remove barriers of access to an entity that will pay for health insurance claims on behalf of Americans and those who are lawfully present within the United States. The Affordable Care Act at its heart is payer reform. It's not a bill that reforms major aspects of the delivery of care across the broad spectrum. It's not a bill that reforms prescription drug coverage in large ways, but it was really about how do we get as many people access to a payer as humanly possible. And before I graduated from law school, to really draw why I'm calling this the most revolutionary law, insurance carriers were permitted to do a few things that I argue are not just immoral, but amoral as an entity where, or as amoral in a society that we want to call civilized. But insurance carriers before the advent of the Affordable Care Act in the vast majority of states were allowed to deny individuals coverage based on what were called pre-existing condition exclusions. And pre-existing condition exclusions could be anything that the insurance carrier deemed to be an untenable risk in bringing you on to their platform because they thought you might cost a little too much money. Beyond that, what pre-existing condition exclusions were used for is ex post facto, after the fact, cancellations and rescissions of policies. So oftentimes what would happen, this is well documented for many, many, many years before the Affordable Care Act, is an individual would have private insurance. They would incur a large cost claim. They would have a major health event that costs a lot of money. And insurance carriers used to go back and dig through medical records looking for reasons to rescind the policy. You didn't disclose that one time you had a hangnail. Therefore, we're not going to cover your heart attack, right? And it was well within the law for them to rescind that policy. Wasn't as much of a problem in the employer-sponsored market. It was a major problem in the individual markets. But it could still happen with companies where insurance carriers say, hey, look, we're not going to issue you a policy because the health claims of your employee workforce are not looking good to our bottom line. The Affordable Care, beyond that, insurance carriers were also able to place caps on the treatment that you would receive under the plan. So when I was in law school, I had a health plan policy that would, I think it only covered transplant care up to $300,000. So if I needed a liver transplant in law school, which doctor was a pretty high probability that I was getting a liver transplant, I would have been ruined, financially ruined. Cause what's a liver transplant cost? $600,000, right? Sure. So right out of law school, I might've been sunk. Now I'm being funny and saying a liver transplant, but that was endemic in the insurance industry where you thought you had coverage, but that coverage was subject to caps for given procedures. And there were also these features called annual limits and lifetime limits, where private insurance plans back then would only cover in a year up to $1 million of claims. I say only, and people are like, only. It's amazing how fast you can hit $1 million of claims in a year. And 5 million in a lifetime. So if you hit 5 million in claims, you're not getting insurance, okay? No one's going to cover you after that point. Those were major variables that led to medical bankruptcy, right? Financial ruin, and just a lack of payer, which results in uncompensated care for the providers who render the care, and to the healthcare providers who render the care. So the ecosystem was incredibly dysfunctional. I mean, was incredibly dysfunctional insofar as that it was premised on how do we pay as little as humanly possible to an individual who might need care? And I don't mean to be that blunt, but I'll be that blunt. That was the business model. Right. And I can safely say I would not be in this industry if that was still the business model. When the Affordable Care Act became the law of the land, it did some major things. It removed annual lifetime limits for what are called essential health benefits. So essential health benefits are 10 buckets of services that health plans are required to cover that you would expect your health plan to cover. If you're paying a monthly premium to an insurance carrier for coverage and you find out that it doesn't cover a liver transplant, would you be pretty upset about paying into that policy? That can't happen anymore, right? The insurance policy must cover the bucket of service. And if it's considered one of the 10 essential health benefits, and the essential health benefits are buckets of services like prescription drug coverage, ambulatory care in a hospital setting, primary care access. Like these are, they're buckets of services that are categories of services that fall under those essential health benefits. If you have treatment for an essential health benefit, there is no annual or lifetime limit for the care that you can receive. The only check on the care that you can receive is what's called medical necessity. And that is where the gamesmanship still occurs with insurance carriers, is did the provider that you're meeting with appropriately justify the need for your care? And there's a lot of work to be done on that front. But by and large, once you have an ACA plan, the carrier is required to pay not subject to annual or lifetime limits for those essential health benefits. Additionally, insurance carriers are not permitted to medically underwrite you. What medical underwriting means is that they're asking you questions about your health conditions. They're not allowed to issue you a policy that is reflective of your personal health situation. That's the way it used to work before the Affordable Care Act. They would take a health risk assessment and issue you an individual quote. Now, the only factors that dictate, and I'm speaking globally, there's nuance to this, but I don't want to get bogged down in it. But generally speaking, the only factors health insurance carriers can consider when issuing policies are your age, where you live, and whether you smoke. Okay. Those are the variables they can look at. They can't ask you questions about, are you diabetic? They can't ask you questions about, did you have a rare condition that would make you uninsurable? So what this meant is no matter how somebody presents, they could have stage 4 cancer, they could have HIV or AIDS, they could have a high dollar condition, the insurance carrier is required to take them in and insure them. As a stick to make this work though, the much maligned aspect of the law, publicly at least, was something called the individual mandate. And what the Affordable Care Act said, this was lifted straight from a healthcare law that was passed in 2006 in Massachusetts by then Governor Romney, that we call Romney Care, that was served as a framework for large swaths of the Affordable Care Act. What they said is if we can't medically underwrite, right, and we have to accept risk as it presents, we need as many people in the insurance pool as humanly possible, because if individuals are allowed to sit on the sideline until they get sick and then jump in and buy a health policy that the insurance carrier is required to cover, it doesn't lead to a super viable financial model on any front. And if you think about it this way, Medicare operates much in the same way. We all pay into Medicare throughout our lives, right? Like we all contribute to Medicare throughout our lives. It's funded by tax dollars. And we're all in that pool, right? We're all in that pool because it's the only way it works. In private insurance, the argument was it was exactly the same. So alongside these market reforms and the coverage reforms was a requirement that you had to buy health insurance. And if you didn't buy health insurance, you would be subject to a tax penalty that you would pay for not having health insurance. To make health insurance more affordable, though, for those who might have the hardest time purchasing health insurance, the Affordable Care Act made certain subsidy programs available to individuals who fall within certain income brackets to help them with the cost of the premium. As you can imagine, when you make these market reforms that say no more annual limits, no more lifetime limits, what do you guys think happens to premiums?
They go up.
My argument generally as a high level concept is you have to think about the value though. You can't judge the value of a premium without considering that your coverage is theoretically unlimited.
The one question though, I think that we want to touch upon is, did Obamacare increase the number of people that were insured? Did it work?
Unequivocally, yes. Unequivocally, yes. And it is so staggering how we went from having 50 million uninsured in this country. We had, before the Affordable Care Act, we had anywhere between 50 and 60 million uninsured, and now we're half that number. We're half that number. We're between 20 and 25 million. And I don't want to pick on my friends from Texas, but a large piece of that 20 million is residing in Texas.
And why is that?
Texas has an uninsured rate of, in 2023, it was 21%. And Texas is a really interesting case study because it's going to inform a lot of what we're talking about. But when I look at Texas, Texas did not sign on to all of the programs that were available and made available to the states under the Affordable Care Act. One of the major pieces of the puzzle of the Affordable Care Act was something called the Medicaid expansion. Insurance carriers really get nervous about what they call adverse selection, and there being individuals who are going without insurance and then jumping into private insurance. And on the physician side and hospital side, there is a reasonable concern about what's called uncompensated care, where if an individual shows up with nobody standing behind them and they need life-saving care, it's the ethical duty of a hospital to stabilize an individual who presents in the emergency room, and hospitals do amazing, miraculous work to do this. But to not get compensated for that care can be a major knock, especially in rural communities, in communities that have a physician shortage or supply shortage. You want to have a payer behind it. So the Affordable Care Act said the way we're going to do this is we're going to expand eligibility for Medicaid based solely on household income. The only qualifying variable is really going to be household income. And it's going to be a federal-state partnership where the state pays 10% over a period of time, and this federal government pays 90% of the cost of Medicaid. What that did, right, is it in my state of Pennsylvania, we went from an uninsured rate of about 11% down to about 4%.
So I think we need to make something clear that unlike Medicare, which is 100% paid for by the federal government, Medicaid is a shared expense between the state and the federal government. It's still that way under the ACA, but the amount the federal government pays is far more than it used to.
100%, yes. And what has happened, so Medicaid eligibility was expanded based on the federal poverty level table. And the federal poverty level, whether you're considered in the federal poverty level table is contingent on your household size. So to put a round number on it, a family of four, I don't have it right in front of me, but let's call it anywhere between $30,000 to $40,000 is what's going to qualify. An income of $30,000 to $40,000 is what's going to qualify you for Medicaid in a state that has engaged with the Medicaid expansion. The states had a choice. Do you want to participate in this program or do you not want to participate in this program? And it tracks fairly closely red state, blue state. Okay. It tracks fairly closely red state, blue state. Texas is a very interesting case study, though, because my assumption had always been that Texas was having this 21% uninsured rate because of their refusal to sign on to the Medicaid expansion. The studies most recent studies that I've read, though, say that would maybe take you from 21% to 16%. So there's something else happening in Texas, and the studies further support that the outstanding 16%. Would likely qualify for some level of assistance through the government exchange to buy a private plan, receive subsidized coverage. Why they aren't even looking at that market option, I don't know. I have theories, and I think it has to do with the media that people consume. and whether they even know to look for coverage at that place. But Texas is an alarming uninsured rate relative to the rest of the country. And I went on that tangent because you asked, did the Affordable Care Act take our uninsured rate down? The answer is yes, substantially. But we still have states that have not embraced the totality of the Affordable Care Act and are still languishing at over 10% uninsured.
Okay, so we now know pretty much what the insurance market looks like. There are going to be undoubtedly in the near future all kinds of proposals to how to reform them from one end, which is sort of where the Republicans are, where they're going to do replace Obamacare despite its success, to the left, which is going for a single payer system. And you may want to explain what that means. Given what you've seen so far and that you've been in Washington recently, do either of these things have a chance? And if so, which one is the more likely?
So let's take a step back and just talk philosophically real quick about the left and the right in Washington, D.C. and how they view healthcare generally. I tend to work with the middle. When I go to Washington, D.C., I am working predominantly with people like the Problem Solvers Caucus. Okay. And the Problem Solvers Caucus is a bipartisan caucus of people who just like to get some things done and are able to have a reasonable conversation with their colleagues across the aisle. But let's talk about the extremities. Okay. And talk about what the extremities of the left and right look like from a health policy. I'm going to start at the left because the left's not in power right now. On the left side, there has been a major question that I understand this question, and I am not somebody who's going to say it's not a valid question. It is a totally valid question, is why do we, the richest nation on earth, have a system that utilizes private insurance, this mishmash of private insurance, government payers, charity payers, instead of just having one single payer like other Western European nations tend to have, and most countries tend to have, not just Western European nations, but the most successful programs tend to be in Western Europe. I'm going to use France and Denmark as my two examples today when I talk about this. The question is, why don't we have what France and Denmark has? So what do France and Denmark have? They have a system where the state doesn't just pay for health insurance claims or healthcare claims. The state owns the healthcare system and the delivery of care. In France, this is a major difference between the United States and these other countries that people need to understand when you're evaluating positions here. But in France, they own the medical school, they own the physicians' practices, they own the distribution of care, right? They're doing all the negotiations with medical device companies and prescription drug companies, and they're the ones who are leading in that negotiation, saying to third parties that work with their government, if you want access to our population, here's the price you're going to pay, right? It's not so much a negotiation as it is, if you want access, here it is. The flip side to that system, and I don't want to rush this because this is important. The flip side to that system is it's just completely different. It's completely different than where we are right now in the United States. And it was developed right after World War II. So the French national healthcare system was established in 1945, right after the war, and built in a super linear fashion with the idea that we are going to guarantee healthcare as a right to the French citizenry. And in order for us to do that, we have to have an organized view of how we get there. Every policy that they pass in France is scored from a healthcare perspective, right? So when you hear about the French getting 8 weeks of paid vacation, when you hear about the French getting paid parental leave, when you hear about the French having subsidized college education, when you hear about physicians in training having subsidized medical school, it's all with the idea that we are paying for healthcare. And how do we put our citizenry in the most viable position for us to be able to afford this proposition? But the flip side for a physician in France is you make a lot less money, right? Medical school is all but free. You're talking hundreds of dollars, not hundreds of thousands of dollars like it is in the United States. And in exchange for that free education, you go work for the national healthcare system where you might make 100,000 euros a year as a physician, right? As a primary care physician. That's about a third of the average salary for a primary care physician in the United States. So it's about a third less. So on the left, they're asking, why don't we have that system, right? Why don't we have this system that's consistently ranked number one in the world? The French system is consistently ranked number one in the world. And they ask it in good faith. And a lot of people have been to France and said, people seem to like it. You know, it seems like it works all right. They complain about everything else, but they seem to like this. And they ask in good faith, why don't we have that system? Well, in the United States, we took a very different path in building our healthcare system. And it was not linear. I used the descriptor that our healthcare system metastasized, right? It metastasized over about 70, 80 years, maybe even 100 years, depending on how far back you really want to go, where in a very non-coordinated fashion, major pieces of legislation were passed in an uncoordinated manner that led to ballooning interests within those legislative frameworks. So what do I mean by that? With all of these laws, people have made money, and they've made a lot of money. And I put the Affordable Care Act in that bucket as well. With all the Medicare, Social Security Act, with ERISA, the passage of ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, with passage of HIPAA, industries explode around these laws, right? And the entire context of our healthcare system can be articulated in terms of dollars and cents. So when we go to Washington, D.C. to talk about something like single payer, or anybody who's going to go to advocate for Washington, for single payer in Washington, D.C. has to be prepared to walk into a circular firing squad of interests. The American Medical Association, my professional association, the PHRMA, which is the Prescription Drug Association, they all spend a lot of money because, don't you know, they're not the problem. It's everybody else. And in our system on Capitol Hill, House members only have a 2-year term, right? So every 2 years you're having turnover, and the people who come in are not experts, and they're hearing from PHRMA, you can't do that because that's going to impact X. They're hearing from AMA, you can't do that because that's going to impact X. They're hearing from us, you can't do any of this because it's going to mess over the American healthcare consumer, to where to build that national system that France has. I'm not going to call it an impossibility, but it is an impossibility in our current political structure, me being a total realist. Another variable of that system, another feature, I'm going to switch to Denmark real quick, because Denmark's and the Scandinavian countries are a great example of this. The European countries put a lot of pride in well-being. And well-being is where I invest a lot of my time talking about what health policy is possible. And well-being is a recognition that health outcomes is not dictated solely by what doctor you see, right? When we talk about health policy in the United States, Andrew and Dr., you know, when we talk about health, we talk about three buckets of things. We talk about prescription drug costs, hospitalization costs, and insurance costs. That's the extent of our healthcare policy discussion. We do not
have a healthcare system, or is it a disease care system?
It's a disease. Hit the nail right on the head. Our system is reactive. Our system is, we are the best at treating complex conditions that could have easily been avoided by interventions earlier in life. In France and Denmark, food processing standards, environmental standards, right, which are major drivers of chronic conditions in our country, mental health standards, things like mandating vacation, things like mandating paid parental leave, things like mandating childcare, which are major stressors in all of our lives, are factored into the healthcare conversation because they know that if you can remove those negative, those variables that can really negatively impact somebody's well-being, that you have a greater risk of having a low-cost patient over a lifetime. In the United States, you know, we miss every opportunity to have this conversation. I use the examples of East Palestine and Flint, Michigan, when back in, I think it was 2011, Flint, Michigan had a major water poisoning crisis where lead pipes poisoned an entire population, where the potential financial liability for medical claims in the future of that population is in the billions of dollars. In East Palestine, Ohio, we had a train derailment that spewed chemicals into the atmosphere akin to a mini Chernobyl that drifted into my state of Pennsylvania, and nobody knows what the future financial impacts are. So single payer, the way that I describe single payer to somebody who is an advocate right now is I would dream of my son, who's 4 years old, having a single payer system. But we have a lot of heavy lifting to do to build the framework to even have a chance of supporting that single payer system. So what I mean by that is if I look at Denmark and I look at Sweden and Finland and Norway that have some of the finest single payer systems on the planet, what's their obesity rate?
Well,
15 to 20% at the absolute high end, but 15%. What's our obesity rate?
40 to 50.
40 to 50. What's our overweight rate?
That's even higher, yeah.
Even higher, right? When I look at a heat map of obesity across this country and I think about single payer, I say, if we don't address that variable, which is not effectively addressed in the doctor's office alone, right? It's not effectively addressed in the doctor's office alone. There is no way that we can afford to sustain not just a single payer system, but our private system, the system that exists today generally. Because the amount of cost when I work with health plans and I see the dollars that go in and out, the costs that kill health plans are chronic diseases that grind year over year that might have been avoidable through earlier interventions. But my dream would be that we start talking about investments rather than cost alone, right? And what's the value of an investment? I hate when I see people throw around large numbers for shock value without including an X and Y axis. I want to see what that cost is to be able to evaluate, is this a worthwhile investment? When I see large numbers just thrown around as a shock value, I get very concerned because I see a lot of capability for us to make smart investments to start building the ecosystem that to address social determinants of health that you can't address in the doctor's office. You don't have the bandwidth to, right? So when I look at the opportunity, hey, let's partner with the Department of Education because we need to meet people where people spend their days. And there are two primary opportunities to do this, at least in my estimation. It's public schools and jobs. We need to take a look at what we feed our kids from the age they're 7 years old until they're 18 years old and look at the nutritional value of the food that we're feeding them. And is it good for the long-term viability of a program like Medicare? Anytime I speak
to the kids about what it means to interact with a healthcare system, what it means to be well.
So you got it. I call it a curriculum of adulting. How do you adult? Andrew's laughing. He gets the hashtag adulting. Our country does a terrible job of preparing kids to be adults, right? And part of being an adult is knowing how to take care of yourself and really knowing how nutrition operates. Andrew and I were taught the food pyramid, right? I think mm-hmm. we all can say the food pyramid is probably not like the best advice to have bread form the basis of your diet, right? I think most of us can agree with that, but that was like the extent of my health education as a kid. Physical education, you know, should be a big part of it. How do you recreate? How do you put your body in a position to be able to move for as long as humanly possible? But what I really advocate for, because this is one of the major predictors of future health outcomes, is financial literacy. And how do you navigate finances? So we lobbied for a law in Pennsylvania, one of the first states to pass this law that mandates public schools beginning in 2026 to offer a course on financial literacy. What is compound interest? Because I can tell you, I took out student loans as a liberal arts major, not understanding compound interest. And it took me until I was 36 years old to pay off those student loans. I'll be 40 this year. It took me until I was 36 years old. That was stressful. And that stress could easily have an impact on future health outcomes for somebody who can never get out from under it. Credit card debt, why you need to have, you know, what should you think about when buying a home? How do you save? How do you invest? How do you make your money work as efficiently as possible? But doctor, I say all of that because at the public school level, we should have a K through 12 curriculum that teaches kids how to be an adult and navigate the world. Because once you step out of high school, you are on your own in this country. And you got to have the skills you need in order to navigate.
When did you ever use trigonometry after you took trigonometry?
Right. Yeah. So
physics, you probably haven't.
So there's a way. So in Pennsylvania, I'm excited to see the curriculum that's built because there's a way to make this engaging, a way to make it work. So I want to see that type of investment, which I think paves the way to being able to hopefully within a generation support a single payer system, right? I want nutrition education. But then beyond that, we need to be engaging with employers. People spend their day with employers. When you look at companies in, say, Germany, right, which has this hybrid system that has aspects that are somewhat similar to the United States, but some key differences. Employers where they're not as intimately involved with the direct administration of health plans, they still invest in their employees' well-being. They still have well-being programs because the interest between the employer having a healthy, vibrant, productive workforce and their bottom line is unequivocal. And one of my great gurus who I love, this guy, Dr. Ray Fabius, who used to be the chief medical officer for GM, who I took a course in population health management with a few years ago. He published a study a few years ago that showed a clear correlation between publicly traded companies that make an outward statement in investing in a culture of health and their bottom line, their stock performance. So the interest between a business and having a healthy, vibrant population that people want to be a part of, a culture that people want to be a part of, and the profitability of their country, of their company is unequivocal. And is anybody going to doubt the German profitability of their companies and their models? Yeah. So
I want to talk about one other aspect of this that's been discussed recently in the press a little bit, which is the lack of readiness of our military. Because young people are not able to pass the tests they need to become soldiers, and particularly apparently the Navy, it's really hurting for people.
So you've got it. I mean, this is you just hit the nail on the head of the opportunities to expand the importance of this conversation. Right? It is a national security risk that only 35% of the adult population is potentially able to pass a physical fitness test to serve this country. Right? That is a national security issue, right? Beyond that, you know, if you are entering the obese range early in life, the odds that that Medicare is going to be able to remain solvent assuming this risk is a major issue, right? It's a major. But what I love about some of these other countries is they don't speak in terms of just dollars and cents. They speak in terms of investment. And what would I rather invest my money in? Would I rather invest my money in just waiting to do what you described earlier, doctor, which is wait for people to get sick, wait for people to show up at your office and pay for however they present? Or maybe we just be thoughtful and invest money in programs that actually improve the quality of their life and give them a chance to pursue happiness and give them a chance to build wealth and to be a functioning member of society to avoid avoidable health conditions, to put them in the best position possible to avoid avoidable health conditions.
So we know this is obviously we've gone through a lot. Yeah, a lot of this is
quite. My wife asked me, do I get paid by the word? So I said, no, but that's a lovely idea.
Well, I think what most people would ask you at this point is what's the next step toward getting where you'd like to get, given what's going on in Washington right now, where there's an immense deregulatory push and a bit of a lot of people who oversee some of this stuff losing their jobs.
Yeah,
is it really going to be possible to propose a process or some way to get from where we are to where we want to be? And so if it is, that's sort of what you do.
Yeah, so let's talk about the right, because I just talked about the left.
That's what I wanted to get to, because I know we talked about the left, you know, why it may not be possible to have it in this country, the downfalls, the positive benefits. What is the right proposing, and is that the right approach to solve some of these problems that you talked about?
So the last unrealistic point on the left that they need to have a compelling answer to get to where they want to go that I have not heard yet, aside from how are you going to train physicians in our to support a single payer system, especially primary care physicians, when the cost of medical school is $250,000 on average? How are you going to overcome the geographical differences in this country between here and France, right? France is the size of Texas. We're the size of Europe, right? So we're not really analogous from a geographical perspective. But importantly, too, it's important to understand that Medicare and Medicaid pay about a quarter of what the private market pays in reimbursement rates. So a lot of healthcare providers will tell you, we consider Medicare charity care, and we're subsidized off the private market. So any cuts that come to Medicare show up in the private market. It's a phenomenon they call cost shifting. So if you go into Medicare reimbursements across the board, that is a massive amount of money coming out of the system. Inorganically, I would argue inorganically, because you would be saying to physicians who had built practices based on both models that from now on, you're going to accept Medicare, which is a quarter of what the private market generally pays. So that's a challenge. That's a real challenge and impediment on the right.
And that can really, if you remove that Jenga piece, it could topple over the American healthcare system.
It could topple over the entire economy, right? Because the American healthcare system is about what I think 20% of our overall, 17%. Yeah, 17% of our overall economic might is revenue generating the healthcare sector. So that's not a small amount of money that would be coming out of our economy generally. That you need to have a thoughtful ramp to move that direction. And things like AI and moving to non-physician led models of primary care might have some promise there. I am skeptical though. I think that those are efficiencies that are just going to lead to bigger bottom lines in the near term for those who adopt them. But on the right side, let's talk about what they envision. They think the Affordable Care Act covers too much, right? They think that the definition of essential health benefits that health plans are required to cover are too broad, and they are very broad. I would even say that the essential health benefits that are mandated under the Affordable Care Act are broader than what's mandated in France and mandated in other countries with single payer programs. They are broad, and there's a reasonable conversation to be had regarding where you can draw some lines with essential health benefits as being mandated coverage. But we got a glimpse of what their proposals are going to look like in the very near term future in two primary places that I lived through intimately. One was in 2017 when the Trump administration tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act the first time, gave us a deep insight into where the philosophical differences sit between the right and the left. And then also Project 2025, which is, I don't care what you believe during the election, it is the basis of what this administration is actively doing. When the gentleman who's the key authors is the head of the Office of Management and Budget, which is one of the most powerful positions in Washington, D.C. right now. And you can go read the chapter on healthcare and they'll tell you what they see. But what I saw in 2017 was a quest for less expensive insurance premiums. I saw in the proposal that went to repeal the Affordable Care Act, a winnowing down of what's required to be covered in an effort to get insurance premiums lower. But what I saw missing in that law was the X and Y axis of value, right? That my concern, my primary concern with what was proposed by the Republicans back then was, A, I didn't think they thought it through all the way. I don't think they thought they were going to be in the position. I remember asking Paul Ryan's office, who was the Speaker of the House at the time, leading up to the conventions, what their vision was for help repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act to see if we could be any help to help him evaluate. He had nothing at the time. A couple weeks later, he released a 25-page document called A Better Way, which was at best a loose framework for repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. But the Affordable Care Act's a big law, and it's a Jenga game unto itself, right? So when I saw that proposal from Paul Speaker Ryan's office, I was actually very concerned that there wasn't really a plan. And then when Trump came into office, he had an infrastructure bill with a bow on it that he could have taken a run at to pass to get a legislative win early in his first term. Instead, he said, no, you guys have been talking about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act for 6 years. Let's do it. You know, 7 years. Let's do this thing reasonably. I thought he was reasonable in that. Yeah, you guys must have a plan. You've been talking about it. And you could hear the panic on Capitol Hill. Like, uh-oh, we got to come up with something quick. So they came up with was essentially skinning down the requirements of coverage under the Affordable Care Act, which I argue was a form of pre-existing condition exclusion reimplementation, skinning down the types of subsidies that were available in the individual marketplace, allowing more novel plans to proliferate, like things like health sharing ministries and cost sharing ministries that I am concerned about because they're usually not regulated by state insurance departments and they have a propensity to go belly up when the capital runs out. And then a big piece of it was completely reforming the Medicaid expansion. And it came very close to passing. This all came very close to passing. What you saw was an awakening for a period of time where the Affordable Care Act started polling north of 60%. And when you asked individuals about the individual provisions about the ACA, they polled fairly well. And it failed by one vote by John McCain, who was looking at the time for a reason to poke Donald Trump in the eye. And look, we exploited that because we did not think that that law as written was even close to ready for prime time. And it would have, by the most conservative projections, resulted in about 30 million uninsured again. Okay. It would have resulted in about 30 million uninsured. As I sit here today and look at what is coming down in this era of deregulation, the easiest way to think about it is the only way that they're proposing your insurance premiums get cheaper is by skinning down the coverage, right? So you have to ask yourself as a healthcare consumer, anybody who's listening to this, you have to pay attention right now. You really have to pay attention. You have to be engaged and you have to ask yourself a question. Do these proposals actually impact me? There's been a longstanding thought that employers should not be involved at all in health insurance. So one of the proposals I wholly expect to see over the next few years is eliminating or heavily capping the deductibility of employer-sponsored health coverage. One of the reasons why businesses offer health insurance is it's an unlimited deduction. It's an unlimited business deduction, which is a carrot that's used to get employers to get in the game. This is a huge bucket of money that can fund a lot of things like tax cuts, right? So the employer exclusion is on the table right now. So what I would expect to see is either the elimination of the deductibility of employer-sponsored coverage or the heavy capping of employer-sponsored coverage, meaning that the deductibility might be capped at $7,000 a year, and every dollar above and beyond that that the plan costs is taxable income to the employee. That's a major change, right? So that's something to pay attention to. Beyond that, just on Wednesday, the budget proposal that we saw in the upcoming budget negotiation had $880 million in cuts to Medicaid proposed. I'm sorry, $880 billion. Of cuts to Medicaid proposed. Guys, that's the entirety of the program. Yeah. That's the entirety of the program. So when we talk about a Jenga game and we talk about pulling the wrong peg, the Medicaid expansion plays a very important role in supporting the private insurance markets and supporting Medicare and supporting the other payer markets, because again, it gives individuals access to payers to make sure that providers are getting compensated for the care that they render and to make sure that as many providers accept Medicaid is humanly possible. You have to make those payments as attractive as possible, right? So we don't want rural hospitals getting hit with uncompensated care where they're teetering on the edge, but they're in a community that's been ravaged by fentanyl, and they're offering treatment. They need to be compensated for that care. So we need to pay attention to that. Beyond that, it's also where 6 million Americans a year get their long-term care through. And this is where all of us, many of us, have had family members who enter long-term care. They cannot afford to pay for it. They have to get rid of their assets in order for Medicaid to take care of them because that's the only option they have. We do a terrible job with long-term care in this country. It's a travesty. And I wish we spent more time talking about it because the other countries we talk about, it's a major point of pride is how they treat their senior citizens and how they age with dignity. In this country, Medicaid is one of the only bulwarks we have to deliver long-term care to individuals who can't afford to self-fund care. How much does it cost to self-fund long-term care? About $300,000 on average. Andrew, you're going to say something. And again, I shouldn't have drank that 25-ounce Red Bull before I got on this call.
No, I love it. I love it. No, I was just going to basically ask you, you know, me as a person, I work at Microsoft. I get my benefits through them. What is the employee capping? How does that affect me or, you know, individuals like me who are working for big corporations like Microsoft?
It's a great, Great question, because it can be a little confusing. When you enroll in your employer's health plan, now Microsoft is a huge company that's self-funded. I don't want to get into the details there, but let's just pretend that your company's partner with an insurance carrier who's selling you a policy at UnitedHealthcare, Independence Blue Cross, or Blue Cross, whomever. The employer is paying a portion of the cost of your premium. Okay. So what the dollar amount that your employer's offering you is less their contribution toward the plan. So the cost of the premium as a whole for just myself might be $600 a month. Okay. The premium as a whole, $600 a month, my employer might pay 80% of that premium. So that remainder is mine. If the employer exclusion cap is implemented, any dollar that my employer is giving me that exceeds that threshold is considered taxable income to me. There was a provision of the Affordable Care Act that was repealed in 2019 called the Cadillac tax that operated in the same way, but we effectively lobbied to get it repealed. That was a huge initiative that we had because we thought it would be catastrophic, right? For a lot of reasons. This is like the Cadillac tax on steroids, where you cap the deductibility and every dollar above and beyond that is taxable. So what do employers do in that scenario? They limit their contribution to the cap, right? They limit their contribution to the cap. And then that cap, this is somewhat technical, but that cap usually gets tied to the consumer price index for how it increases year over year. The consumer price index is an average of all consumer goods. Where do you think healthcare falls on that continuum? At the low side or the high side?
High side.
Excellent.
Very high side.
The highest of the high side, right? So that consumer price adjustment over years is going to get way out of whack with the cost of insurance, and you will see employers just dropping their plans and sending you to the individual market to buy whatever's available there, keeping in mind that if the ultimate goal is repealing the Affordable Care Act, you're going to be buying policies that don't have the market protections that the Affordable Care Act has in place. I view some of these policies as a fast track to single payer, right? That if you go this direction and you pull the wrong Jenga peg, don't be surprised if people rush into a single payer conversation before the country's ready to handle it.
And remember, we have a single payer system if you're over 65.
You got it. You got it.
We don't have an American single payer system. We do. It works.
You got it. It works in that population, but to expand it beyond that population is a challenge, and that's a challenge that I think is. Not a 2-year challenge or a 4-year challenge. I think it's at least a 10-year challenge. Now, running alongside of this, and I before the current events and where we are today, I looked at Congress and I said the reality is the money on Capitol Hill is going to make it really hard to pass a law that would address everything that needs to be addressed to move to a national healthcare system for everyone, unless you have campaign finance reform, right? You'd have to have campaign finance reform. Which I think is highly unlikely, right? I think campaign finance reform is extraordinarily unlikely, at least today. We'll see where we are in 4 years or in 2 years during the midterms. But where I'm optimistic is the private sector. There are a lot of people who are looking at healthcare and looking at well-being and saying, wow, there's different ways of doing this. So just to use a simple example, let's just use Amazon as an example, right? And Amazon is a company, you could use Microsoft as an example, but Amazon is a company that I think has the pieces to do something like this. Amazon's business model is not premised on the good you are buying. It's premised on the data that they're gaining from you, right? So the consumer profile that Amazon builds on a given individual is a multi-trillion dollar industry. Right. So the data that they get about get from consumers and your behaviors, whether it's at Whole Foods, whether it's on Amazon Prime, whether it's your internet browsing history, whatever it is, they're building a profile about you that is highly predictive of your actions. Amazon has intimated that they have serious plans to enter healthcare. Right. If I look at Amazon's ability to upend the healthcare industry, it's in the fact that they do not need to make money off the service. Because they will make so much money off of the data. Now, are we comfortable with that proposition or do we feel good about that proposition? I don't know. But what Amazon has the ability to do is if I look at their membership in Amazon Prime, they might tell you they have 100 million members, but my household's got one membership, right? We're sharing memberships. They really represent the entire consumer market. And if I think about negotiating power, their negotiating power is bigger than any potential negotiating power is bigger than any health insurance carrier in the country, bigger than any health insurance carrier in the world. Their combined assets dwarf them. So when I think about what they could potentially do, and if I was building a 10-year roadmap for Jeff Bezos, it would be, you're going to build primary care clinics. You're going to buy hospitals, right? Like a Kaiser Permanente model or a Geisinger in Pennsylvania, where I live, where the insurance carrier owns the medical school, owns the hospital, owns the entire ecosystem for the delivery of care. The difference, though, with Amazon is that their profit center is the data. So they have a potential to essentially build a single payer system, right? That's incredibly inexpensive in private sector innovation. Now, there's a lot of trade-offs in that conversation, but I look at companies that are data companies eyeing up the delivery of care and saying, why don't we give away primary care? Let's give away primary care and we'll track how people behave after we give them a prescription to get them on a pathway. So think about Amazon. Amazon owns Whole Foods. You can imagine a scenario where Whole Foods has a minute clinic that's staffed by physicians and nurse practitioners, right? Where you go in there, you have your checkup. They say, you got to lose 50 pounds. Here's the shopping list. You got the credit card, the Amazon credit card. Go out, track how they behave, right? The doctor just told you, you got to get your act together, right? Go out, see how they behave and build a consumer profile for that individual where they're essentially giving that care away and selling that data. So that's where I had put my money on. You want to see real disruption? It's in the companies that make money off of data eyeing up the delivery of care.
How do we feel
about that?
I'm two ways about it. Given I work for a tech company, it's part of what helps fund me. But also, you know, how invasive is it going to be with them having all of that PHI data, for example? Are we going to have strict guidelines on what they can and can't use with that information would be my first question.
Yeah. So remember, look, it's a trade-off. It's a value trade-off, right? It's something that you have to constantly keep in mind is what's the value of the good that's being returned. Remember a few years ago, Amazon went into a healthcare venture with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan Chase, and they hired a man who I have great respect for, Atul Gawande, who is just one of the most talented physicians in communicating really complicated topics in a super accessible way, things like end of life care, right? Which is a major cost center in the American healthcare system is how we handle end of life care. He was named as their CEO. It disbanded after a couple of years and everybody said, oh, look, the billionaires couldn't figure out healthcare. I thought that was the wrong message to take away. I thought that the message was actually Amazon didn't need them. I thought that Amazon shuttered the program because they made so much money during the pandemic. They're making so much money off of AWS. And they said, we don't need those players anymore. So the ultimate question will be, if they enter the space in the way that I think they can, what's the value, right? I would argue there's a lot of value in people who can afford to buy real estate, buying medical schools, buying hospitals, training physicians at no cost, having incentives for them to stay in the system, right, to work for them. I see it work in Pennsylvania, in northeastern Pennsylvania, with a system called Geisinger, where northeastern Pennsylvania has had some hard years, and I see this contained model work fairly well. So UPMC, University of Pittsburgh, is another entity that's done this. Kaiser's the big one. They were the original. They were the OG integrated. But you guys can have me back and we can talk about this in greater detail down the road.
That's a good deal. Well, I think you've covered the waterfront fairly well in Health Insurance the United States 101. That was sort of our goal today in identifying the complexity of our system, comparing it with other systems, and knowing where we are today compared to where we were and where we might like to be. So I think it's been real successful in that. Andrew, you want the last word?
No, I don't want the last word. I want Scott to always have the last word, or guests to have the last word. I did want to ask, though, Scott, we talked about the left, what things can offset the system. We talked about the right, what things could offset the system. One of the solutions you're saying is a data company can come in and come in the middle. Are there any other aspects of our healthcare ecosystem that's like a middle ground that you're talking about with a lot of the middle of the road people in Washington?
Yes. And if you can give me two more minutes, I'll talk about the one that I failed to mention that I really wanted to mention, which is we just went through a global pandemic, right? We went through a global pandemic that upended the world. And it was a very stressful time for me. And I'm going to tie this to me personally, because I was consulting with companies, not as a physician doctor, but as a lawyer, where they were calling me, oh, I got a sick guy on the floor. What am I supposed to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not a physician. I'm a lawyer. But it was a very stressful time where the entire world had questions all at once. And, you know, I feel like we have almost a post-traumatic stress disorder where we've acted as if that time didn't happen and that there wasn't a real time of fear with what we were seeing with that disease out in the world. And it was. And I remember about a year into the pandemic, we were still in lockdown. The CDC published a report that said 94% of individuals who died from COVID had comorbidities, a condition alongside of it that made them more susceptible to die. And what disgusted me in that moment was the news media picked this up and ran and said, see, it's only those people with chronic diseases and comorbidities that have a hard time with COVID. Like, let's get moving. And I said, well, wait a minute. That's 60% of the population, right? That's 60% of the population who either has the comorbidity or is on track for a risk factor with developing that comorbidity based on the heels of the obesity data that I talk about, and not including genetic data as well. But it was a huge missed opportunity to say, we need to come out of this pandemic with an understanding that we got to take care of ourselves, right? We have to do a better job of taking care of ourselves. And we need to build an ecosystem that makes it easier for us to take care of ourselves. I'm an example of this, guys. You're looking at a guy who has had 14 months of transformation personally. COVID era was really hard on me. My wife got pregnant the first weekend of lockdown. I was taking calls from thousands of employers regarding scary situations. And my diet went out the window. I started drinking a little too much. You know, when the beer distributor started delivering to the house, you know, I was like, okay. And before you know it, I was almost 300 pounds. I was 293 pounds and I'm 6'1", last December. And thankfully I started working with a nutritionist and a well-being coach that got me to go get my blood work done. And I was in early stages of liver failure. I had stage 2 fibrosis, and I worked with somebody that is the best $100 a month I've ever spent in my entire life, who helped build a plan, keep me accountable, moving, completely changed my diet. And I've lost almost 70 pounds in the past year. And I haven't had a drop of alcohol since January of 2024. Not because I considered that, it was just all of it, my diet, lack of exercise, all of it needed to be upended. My numbers were so bad for the first time in my life, had nothing to do with my doctor, had nothing to do with the healthcare system, had everything to do with the stress I was feeling and the intense emotional experience that was becoming a father during the pandemic with everything that came around that. But within 4 months of dedication and really staying on the straight and narrow, I completely reversed all of those numbers. And I am in the best shape I've been in since, Andrew, the last time you saw me. Right.
Congratulations. So amazing.
So at the end of the day, we have to do better at helping people make these types of changes and put them in a position to where they don't have to have the come to Jesus moment that I had, right? That they're armed when they leave high school, when they leave college. Here's how you take care of yourself. Here's how nutrition works, right? Here's how to exercise. Here's how to balance and find balance between work and enjoying your life. So I hope that we can have a greater conversation about, let's get people on moving toward greater states of health every day, just not within the system.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us. This has been absolutely informative. I was engrossed in every piece of it. I have obviously tons of questions because it's such a deep topic. I just want to say thank you so much. Are there any final words you'd like to give our viewers?
No, thank you for having me. I'd love to come back anytime you guys want to have a conversation. So thank you for having me.
Now that you've laid out the problem, we'll bring you back for the solution.
Let's do it.
Thank you again for joining A New Prescription. I want to give a special thank you to Scott Wham. If you want to continue the conversation, please join us on our social pages at A New Prescription on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and TikTok. You can also join us on YouTube at anewprescriptionyoutube.com. And remember, your health is the most important thing to you. We'll see you next time.